It's often said that British people, or maybe just English people, are obsessed with class, that people very quickly to judge other people in terms of their accent, their education, their upbringing, their job, their manners, and so on. So the fact that this is a talk about class rather than class really means that I'm a posh middle-class southerner, as you'll all have realised by now, if you didn't know that previously. It's sometimes said that if your language is obviously working class, so if you drop your H's and say things like, "Unit," then it's harder to get a job as a lawyer or a journalist. My reaction to this view that British people are obsessed with class is only if only it were true, you know. Just as it's often said that Americans believe that Europe is awash with socialists. Christ, I only wish that were true. It really could be good if British people really were obsessed or had a great interest in class, in the socialist sense of class. But of course, it's not true. People aren't interested in the way we look at class very much. What I'm going to do in this talk is to look at various approaches to and definitions of class, not so much in terms of whether they're right or wrong, but in terms of whether they're useful or not. And I'm going to argue that the socialist approach we will get to eventually is the most useful and helpful. And at the end, I'll talk a bit about what a classist society could be like and one of the things I'll throw open to discussion. So I'm going to look at various definitions of class. I've chosen these in a rather random way, and of course it's impossible to be comprehensive in a talk like this, but I hope there's at least enough there for something to chat about. Clearly, there's a common distinction between the lower or the working class on the one hand, the middle class and the upper class. And that's generally occupation-based, so manual workers, blue collar, don't know what to call it, versus brain workers, so-called, or white-collar workers. And there'll be executives and people up above them and so on. And there are further distinctions. So, for example, Robert Roberts, in his book on Salford in the early 20th century, says that there was a big division between unskilled and skilled manual workers, and that was the main local division in terms of the area where he lived. And above even the skilled manual workers were a fairly small set of clerks, shopkeepers and publicans. So the idea that publicans were part of the sort of relative upper class is quite sort of interesting, I think, really. George Orwell, in a sort of fairly well-known reference, said that he was born into the lower upper middle class. The family had been fairly wealthy, but wasn't any longer, and his father was a civil servant. So it's clear just from those very few examples that there are various approaches to class and to class divisions and so on. Let's look next at Owen Jones' book, Chavs, which is about the way in which the working class, as he sees it, are depicted and often demonised in the media and so on. It's quite a sizable book, and after talking about quite a lot, well into the book, he finally asks, gosh, who are the working class? He might have asked that rather near the start of it, but in the middle he says, who are the working class? And surprisingly enough, the person he asks this question is Neil Kinnock. And even more surprisingly, Kinnock's answer is actually quite good. What Kinnock says is, quote, the working class is people who have no means of sustenance other than the sale of labour are the working class. That's not a bad definition, except that, as we'll be seeing later on, it should be who own their labour power rather than their labour. Jones himself doesn't really accept that or doesn't really make use of it, because what he talks about is more the degrees of control that people have over their labour. So he says, for example, that a university professor has more control over their work than a shop assistant, and no doubt that's true. And he says most people work for others and lack control over their own labour. Again, he's right, of course, most people do work for others, and the extent of their control over their own labour is pretty restricted. And you know, they have to follow orders, they have to do what they're told, they have to work whatever the employer lays down. Yeah. And while I think there's some relevance of that, I don't think it's really the essential, crucial idea of how much control people have over their labour. It's important, but it's not clear that it really matters greatly in terms of a class divide. And of course, it's also a matter of degree. It's not yes or no whether you have control over your labour. Let's look at a more recent and more comprehensive approach. Back in 2014, there was something called the Great British Class Survey, which was carried out partly by the BBC, and also there was a book which emerged from it called Social Class in the 21st Century. Mike Savage is the main author of that, although there's a whole list of authors. And they looked at, I think, 160,000 people just to survey their position in society and so on. And what they did, they looked at what they call different kinds of capitals. Now, capital here does not mean the sense in which socialists understand it, but a much broader idea. So there was economic capital, which was income, the value of your home and your savings, but it was a matter of a household income and value, etc., not just of individual persons. So economic capital, resources, but owning your own house, of course, is a slightly different kind of capital from the capital that socialists talk about. And the second line of capital they distinguished was cultural capital. So you've got sort of more points, as it were, if you liked classical music, if you went to the theatre and to ballet, if you ate out a lot and so on, you've got sort of higher points of that than if you watched television most of the time, or you went to your local pub for some rock music or whatever. So cultural interests and activities was another kind of capital. And the last kind they talked about in this survey was the number and status of people that people knew. So if you knew people from a wide range of different occupations, particularly the more prestigious occupations, then you got more points again in this this sort of study of your capital results and so on. So I would guess, for instance, that most socialists know people from a rather wider range of occupations simply by dint of being members of the party than they would if they just knew people who they grew up with, worked with, lived next door to, or whatever. So there were these three kinds of capital, again, without labouring the point and given a rather special meaning here. And what they did, the people who ran this survey, was that it was supposedly showed the extent of polarisation and class fragmentation in contemporary Britain. So this is 8 years ago, maybe a bit more in terms of when the actual research was done. And what they did, they identified seven classes or categories in this Great British Class Survey. I'm not going to go through them all, so don't get too worried. I'm just going to look at three of them in a little bit more detail. I must say, my impression reading the book was that a lot of this was rather arbitrary in where you draw the lines and so on. But at least clearly there is a distinction to be made. The percentages are from a rather smaller sample survey, so they are to be taken with a little bit of a pinch of salt, the percentages, but I will mention what the percentages are. So at the top were the elite. This was 6% of the population. They got high scores on all the three kinds of capital, and their economic resources, the value of their home, their savings, etc., really set them apart from other people. This included chief executive officers of companies. It also includes dentists and barristers. So, you know, there's a clearly divisions within this so-called elite. And what they say in the book about them is, quote, the power of a relatively small, socially and spatially exclusive group at the apex of British society, whose economic wealth sets them apart from the great majority of the population. So there was this elite group, the top 6% or so. Again, don't take the percentages too literally, but that kind of size. Clearly rather larger than the this common distinction made between the 1% and the 99%. Okay, in addition, I think just below the elite were the what they call the established middle class. This was about a quarter of the population, and they are, quote, the comfortably off bulwark of British society, or Middle England, if you like. So they had fairly high scores from the three kinds of capital, but not as high as the elite. And further down was the traditional working class, about one person in seven, who scored pretty low on all the forms of social of capital, but not the poorest group. Also, they were older than most of the others. I'm not quite sure how that really fits in. As I said, I'm not going to go through all the other divisions that they drew. It's all a bit arbitrary. And it's not just a matter of occupation, as I was saying. It's a matter of income and savings, but also cultural and social things as well, which is, I suppose, fair enough to introduce all these distinctions into it. And what they concluded on the whole was that the stereotypes of working class and middle class are out of date, that the established middle class and the traditional middle class were well under half the population, and there was a great many other divisions too which exist and which, you know, fill out quite a and which comprise a fairly large part of the population. So it wasn't mainly work-related, but those were typical jobs in each class. And but it wasn't a matter of if you do job X, then you're definitely in class Y. That wasn't quite the way it works. As I said, it was a rather arbitrary-seeming set of distinctions. The other thing we would make, I think, is that there was no common interest between the different between the members of these different classes. So you couldn't say, traditional working class share common interests against those above them or those below them in this hierarchy and so on. So from that sense, it wasn't really anything like the socialist analysis of class. Okay, let's step back a bit. Hold on a second. As I was saying to Paddy earlier, I've got a cold and a cough, which is not a good combination, so I'll try not to get too sidetracked in this. Okay, I don't really think it's a matter of right or wrong. I mean, we don't have any copyright over the word class, but of how useful or otherwise these distinctions are. But I rather wonder what would have happened if the criteria used for this great British class survey had been made a generation or two before. What we've shown, for example, clearly the so-called middle class is much larger than it was back in Robert Roberts' day, which is just over a century ago, and probably even more recently, the middle class are larger than was the case then. And the 1930s, for instance, clearly saw a growth in service and distribution jobs and cuts in things like mining and shipbuilding. So in that sense, the traditional working class manual workers are fewer and the white-collar jobs are far more numerous. Okay, let's move on then to look at the socialist view of class. We focus on the economic aspect much more, and specifically the source of a person's income. I saw something on our website forum some years ago, which argued that if you have an income of over £20,000 a year from interest or dividends, then you are in the capitalist class. Now, I'm sure if you made a claim like that nowadays, it'd be rather more than £20,000 a year. And of course, many people in the capitalist class have far more than that. But that's the kind of distinction we are talking about. Enough to live reasonably on without having to work and without relying on a pension, which are, I mean, pensions, remember, are just deferred wages, really. Let's look at another definition from Keith Graham's book on Marx. I've adapted this a bit, so this is not word for word what Keith says. The working class is people who have to offer their labour. The working class is people who have to offer their labour power for sale for a significant proportion of their lives if they are to live at an average, reasonable standard of living in the prevailing historical circumstances, as well as people who are directly dependent for their own livelihood on members of the working class. So you're a member of the working class if you have to sell your labour power in order to live in a reasonable way, plus those who depend on someone, on the sort of wage earner in their household or whatever. So by that definition, clearly there are going to be grades within the working class in terms of how well off people are, but it doesn't really matter in terms of the basic economic setup. There are geographical divides as well. So, for example, generally, the life expectancy, for instance, is rather higher in the southern part of the British Isles than it is in the northern part. And quite apart from the working class, there is this real elite, not the elite who I mentioned earlier, which includes dentists and barristers, but because they are not part of the capitalist class. Dentists and barristers still have to sell the labour power in order to live, but they are not capitalists. They are not the real elite. In the blurb for this talk, I quoted Harari saying that owning a few shares makes you a capitalist. Well, that is complete nonsense. Owning a few shares does not make you a capitalist. And I'll give you another Keith Graham quote. This is something that Steve Finch sent to me. Quote, the ownership of some small quantity of shares no more makes such individuals into capitalists than a cut on the finger makes someone into an invalid. So simply owning a few shares, and I will admit that I do have a few shares that I inherited from my dad, that doesn't in itself make you a capitalist. Let's look a bit more then at the other side of the class divide. The latest Sunday Times Rich List, at the top of the Hinduja family in Britain, 28 billion, the Dyson family, 23 billion, the Rubin family, whoever they are, 22 billion. I mean, these are kinds of money that I'm sure all of you here can read about and look at the figures, not really know, not the slightest idea what they really imply. And we can't even, I suppose I can imagine what £1 billion is like, but 28 billion, what on earth does that mean, really? Elon Musk, who is often described as the world's richest person with something like $330 billion, although I see from today's news that he might be losing that position as the world's richest person, which is a shame, I suppose, really. He always described himself, Musk, as being cash poor, which is why he had to borrow money to buy Twitter. Poor lamb, really. Going back to the Sunday Times Rich List, the guy who who compiles it. And what he said a few years ago was this, quote, when I first started 25 years ago, about two-thirds of the rich list were people who had inherited their wealth. Today, approaching 80% are self-made, and that's really a legacy of the Thatcher years. Now, I suspect there's something in this, that inherited wealth is less important as in making someone filthy rich than it was, and certainly in terms of land ownership and so on. But of course, no one on that rich list is self-made. They got themselves rich by exploiting others, by exploiting the working class. There are lots of statistics of this type, but one that I came across, the 28 richest people in the world own as much as the poorest half of the world's population, which is 3.8 billion. And those people are not self-made. They got there by exploitation. The expression that's used very often is ultra-high net worth. That means you have assets of over, well, did I say you? That means someone who qualifies like that has assets of over $50 million. And there are 200,000 people worldwide, supposedly, who qualify for that. 200,000 people is, I didn't do this calculation, but that is 0.004% of the adult population of the globe. That's really where the elite we were talking about earlier boils down to. Nothing to do with dentists or barristers or doctors or whatever. It's true also that the precise nature of the really wealthiest people, the top, not even the top 1%, perhaps the top half of 1% or even less than that, their sort of background has changed over time, and they don't so much any longer come from landed backgrounds, certainly not from aristocratic ones either. The precise nature of this connection between capital in general and land ownership more particularly is sort of maybe an interesting one that we could talk about in the discussion if you like. Karl Marx, in the last chapter of volume 3 of Capital, said that there were three classes in society: landowners, capitalists and workers, and each of whom had a different source for their income. Now, that last chapter is sort of unfinished, and who knows what Marx would have said had he written more there. But of course, the Socialist Party's Declaration of Principles talks very much about two classes rather than three. And from our point of view, the landowners and the capitalists are one class. They own the means of production, the resources of the planet, the means of life. And there certainly is no clear distinction between a class of capitalists and a class of landowners, even if some get their income, their unearned income, from land or from somewhere else. So socialists then see society as it is now as being consisting of two classes, the capitalists and the workers. Unfortunately, class is not the same thing as class consciousness. And while many capitalists are no doubt class conscious, aware of their own class interests, that's not necessarily, or that is not the case really, for the vast majority of workers, I'm afraid. Most workers don't see themselves as members of the working class. And if they do, they don't really see themselves as forming a class who have interests diametrically opposed to that of the 0.01% or whatever it is. The working class is a class that's not at present a class for itself, a class which is aware of its own interests and aware of not what needs to be done in order to do away with its situation, whatever term you want to use. Yeah. Okay, to conclude, we've seen that many people talk about class under capitalism in various senses, and that socialists have a particular way of approaching class. Our aim is not to fiddle about with the existing class system, but to do away with it completely and establish a classless society. And what we mean by a classless society is not doing away with the aristocracy or a one where there's lots of social mobility, where it's easy for someone who work in a factory to become filthy rich or something like that. Nor is it one where everybody goes to the opera or whatever term in terms of the cultural capital we want to talk about. What it means is that the means of production will be owned not by a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the population, but owned by everyone in common, controlled democratically, and used to meet human needs and so on. Work will be made as satisfying as possible in socialism. People won't be cleaners or teachers or whatever all the time. What one thing we will argue for and aim is equal people to have equal control over their own lives. And I think in one good definition of what democracy is, people really control their own lives in a way that is not possible under capitalism. As we were saying earlier, many workers have very little control over their conditions of work because they are precisely workers and employees. And as far as possible, a socialist society would aim to give people control not just over their working lives, but their lives in general. So a classist society then will do away with many of the problems that class and capitalism imply. And let's hope that people do fairly quickly at last become obsessed with class, and obsessed not just with class, but with doing away with class society and establishing a classless system. Thank you.